Giannis to UCT. George was here last week for the Authentic Learning in Vocational Education Conference that was hosted by the School of Ed and UWC and held at the waterfront. And it's a fantastic opportunity to get somebody who I think most people in the field have read a lot about. You know, a lot of people follow George on Twitter, read his blogs, and are very aware of the kind of research that you're doing. But to be able to hear firsthand from somebody about some of the experiences and knowledge that you have. So thank you, George, and welcome to everybody. We've got a bunch of students here from the PG DIP, as well as colleagues from SILT, CPUT, libraries, past the libraries. So a whole range of people publishing. So thank you.
Thank you. First of all, thanks everyone for taking the time to be here. It's truly a pleasure to come and spend some time with you and share some of my work and get to hear your questions and your comments on some of these things. So thanks a lot. It's been a pleasure and a privilege to be in Cape Town. It's always been a dream to visit this area. I've been here for about 10 days now, and it's been wonderful. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to tell you a little bit about what academics and professors do on social media, or what I think they do, or I guess what I discovered that they do, why they do those things, and ask you a few questions about why you think they do the things that they do. Just a little bit about myself. I live in British Columbia, Canada. I'm originally from Cyprus, but this is what I call home now. And in particular, I live in Victoria, which is at the very bottom of that huge island called Vancouver Island. It's right off the coast of Vancouver, and it's about 25 to 30 kilometers from Seattle. It's very close. And if you talk to Canadians, they'll say that this is kind of the Florida of Canada because it's not cold. It's actually pretty warm there. It's between 10 and 20 degrees Celsius throughout the year. So it's a great place to be. I'm at a small university called Royal Roads. And this is kind of what it looks like. It used to be a military academy, but we have about 5,000 students. But at any point in time, about 1,000 or even less might be on campus. All of our students come for 2 weeks at the beginning of their degree in a residency. So they spend 2 weeks where they go through face-to-face courses and then do the rest of their degree online. Right? So it's a two-year degree with 2 weeks with us, trying to build community and trust and all of those things. And they go on and do the rest of it online. So in the School of Education where I am, our students come in July. And then they go off back to their work and their families. Most of our students are full-time professionals, working professionals, and the average age is between 35 and 40 years old. So we're a different kind of institution than the traditional North American university that hosts 18-year-olds or 19-year-olds and so on. Some other interesting things about the institution, we have a flexible admissions policy, which means that our students can be admitted based on their undergraduate qualifications, or they can also be admitted based on their experiences and working life if they don't have an undergraduate qualification. So if they don't have an undergraduate degree, they may be admitted based on the work that they've done in their workplace, right? So the idea is that people might have learned some of the things that we want them to learn before they start their degree, but outside of the formal university space, so we recognize that. So I hope that gives you a little bit of background, kind of who I am and what I do for work and where. My research focuses on understanding people. So I like to talk to people to understand what their experiences are like when they are online. So what is it like to be an online student? What challenges do people face? What challenges do they face in new environments? So for example, we've been doing a lot of work around MOOCs, right? So what challenges do students face there? what are their experiences when they're asked to peer review other students' work, what are the experiences of faculty when they're asked to teach online or where they're told to teach online, right? Or, as I was talking with Alan a little bit ago, what might be someone's experiences when they're asked to try out a new assessment technique and so on. So that's kind of what I try to make sense of, and to instill kind of some humanity in this space that we call digital education. So here's an overview for today. I'll talk about network scholarship and what that is. Then I will discuss what I've seen my research professors do on social media. I'll answer why they are on social media, and I'll discuss some of the challenges that they face. But before I go into kind of the formalities of what network scholarship is, I wanted to give you a couple of minutes to explore that topic with your neighbor. So if you could indulge me and turn to the person to your right or to your left, and essentially ask, what is network scholarship? Ask the person next to you what they think that stands for, and then I'll get some ideas back from you, and I'll tell you what I think it is. All right? Any questions before we do that? Any thoughts? I have to pick on the people whose names I know. Yeah, jump in.
I just had a wonderful conversation with Lena, where she prefers online engagement and networking to group work. And so much of our interaction with students is around face-to-face group work. And I think it's really fascinating to hear from someone who is so engaged online, but yet would be uncomfortable in face-to-face group work. And I think it's an important message that we need to acknowledge.
Yeah. Thank you. Other thoughts?
So network scholarship would probably be a scholar who is able to communicate their ideas online in various platforms and using collaborative tools that people out there generally use.
The question that came up between two of us is, what is a scholar? What is scholarship? Who is a scholar?
That's a great question.
Okay. Before you start networking, let's figure out who's a scholar and who's not.
That's a great question.
My first idea was research. When I saw the word scholarship, I didn't think about scholar, a person, but necessarily collaborative or network research online leading to publications, journals, that kind of thing.
Great. So I have the idea of research versus scholarship, maybe, and what is scholarship and what is research.
Yeah.
So I hand here.
Yeah, and I was just thinking, for me, the first thing that came to mind was George Seaman's work of personal learning networks, of learning through your networks, obviously professionally, and in this case it would be from academics related in a network that are connected, mm-hmm. and learn from each other, which was what we were talking about.
We also noted on the network, what we are doing here, we are really networking, but we are not online. So maybe the online part is to enhance it.
All right, those are great thoughts, and they align, all of them actually align with some of the things I'm going to talk about, so keep them in mind. Some of the questions that were raised, for example, who is a scholar and whether network scholarship is research and what, you know, counts under that, might be things that we'll talk about at the end. So let me tell you what I think network scholarship is. But in my kind of worldview, it's a scholar's use of social technologies to kind of share, reflect, critique, improve, and further their scholarship. and I take a broad perspective on scholarship, and I take it to mean research, teaching, and learning. So if you look at some of the original work on what is scholarship and what counts as scholarship, some of Boyer's work, this fits under that. So it's not just research, but research is definitely included under here. It's a non-deterministic perspective, and by that I mean there's no stance here about technology improving scholarship or being detrimental to it, but it's a framework to understand kind of the things that people do online, and to understand what are the implications of doing those things online. All right, so for me, even though some of our activities may be improved by being done online, some other ones might not be improved, and some of our activities might shape the types of some of our scholarly activities, like writing a paper, might shape the types of things that we're doing online, right? So so in that sense, it's non-deterministic. You will hear terms like digital scholarship, social scholarship, and open scholarship, and I wanted to kind of show the distinctions between some of these terms. Digital scholarship traditionally focuses on the technology and how technology can improve various things. For example, the platform that allows scholars to share their data could be, you know, framed in digital scholarship sense because it allows a more efficient sharing of data. Social scholarship emphasizes the use of social technologies like social media for collaboration and for sharing in particular. And open scholarship focuses on this idea of broadening access and sometimes has little to do with the technology. So for example, a Creative Commons license that allows other individuals to make copies of my paper and share them with everyone else, it might fall under the open scholarship paradigm, but has nothing to do with technology per se. Or it might, if you know, if technology is used to replicate the product. So now let's turn to the word networked, which Peter mentioned. You might have to do with face to face as well as online, but in online settings. There's a language that's being developed in the social network analysis space that essentially defines what networks are. So you think of this individual as someone who has a blog, and you want to map this individual's interactions with other people. You might call this individual a node, and this is another individual in that space, and they're connected with an edge. So that second person might leave a comment on the first person's blog, so you would visualize that that relationship in that way, right? So as you keep on adding more individuals to this space, and as these individuals leave comments to other people's spaces, over time, you get some sort of a graph, right, that shows the relationships between people. This is essentially my LinkedIn profile network space visualized with one of the tools that LinkedIn has. And you can see different clusters here. So for example, the blue cluster on my right is the people that I went to school with. And then the orange cluster on the left is people who I work with. So these individuals share various characteristics. So over time, they get grouped into different parts, and over time this network expands, right? So some people are very well situated right here, whereas others share more characteristics with each other, so they might find themselves in different overlapping clusters. So if you think about an academic in a school of education, right, the blue cluster might be all the academics that he's connected with that do research on the particular topic that he does research on. And the green cluster might be people from a different discipline that share some of their research interests. So they might be people from educational psychology who are interested in education and so on. So in recent years, we've seen interesting desires for people to engage with networks and to engage with some of the practices that fall under network scholarship. So an interesting desire to engage with in conversations about what blogs might have to contribute to scholarship, what the public intellectual looks like, what does it mean to, you know, write for a mass audience, what does it mean to connect with other colleagues on Twitter and so on. So the question is, well, why is there this increasing desire to engage with? And by engage with, I don't necessarily mean do these things, but also have conversations around these things, right? We've seen universities encourage academics to be on social media. We've seen obviously evangelists say that this spaces have lots of positives to offer, but we've also seen pushback, right? And we'll talk about some of the pushback in a little bit. So why the increasing interest? There's the expectation that some major breakthroughs that are going to occur by engaging in non-traditional ways of doing scholarship. The hope for a variety of positive outcomes, like reduction in costs, increasing access to scholarship to individuals who might not otherwise have access to, as we see publishers and publishing companies have various strategies that prevent scholarship to be accessed by everyone. We've seen also academics figure out different ways to share their scholarship beyond those who can afford the fees that the libraries pay to publishers. And we've seen a lot of research interest in trying to understand what this means. So the last point about examining networks is basically a scholarly comment about what does this mean for scholarship. We've also seen how networks in recent years have arisen that function outside what the university formal structure provides. So just to give you an example, there's a group called PhD Chat, and it's essentially a hashtag that exists on Twitter. And it's frequented by PhD students, right, and professors and so on. But the reason that people go there is because that space allows people to talk about the challenges that they're facing at their university. It allows them to talk about the research that they're doing in kind of a networked global way, right? If you think of a PhD student at a university doing their research, they're usually the one or two individuals at that institution looking at that topic. And PhD Chat has allowed people to find others who are doing similar research on the topic. So outside of the formal university structure, there's this place, this informal place that was set up by two university students that just wanted to talk with other PhD students about the topic, and has functioned as a place to provide support to students who are looking for that support. So let's look at this question next. What do individuals do on social media? I think one of the items that needs to be highlighted is there's technologies that were developed for academic social networking, and then there's the technologies that are reused or repurposed for those means. So for example, things like academia.edu, Mendeley, and Zotero were developed for academics, were developed for academic social networking. And then there's other tools that were never developed for those purposes but are redefined to serve needs that the academics have. So Twitter and Facebook and so on, right? In some ways, these technologies are flexible enough to be repurposed for academic uses. But when academics go on them, we often see how the design of the platform shapes the kind of things that they do. So I'm going to list just a bunch of activities that we uncovered when we looked at scholars' activities online. These are things that academics can be seen doing when they have a blog, when they have a Twitter space. The sharing of draft papers, I think, is an important one because it questions the traditional way that scholarship is done in academia. Right? The traditional way is I'm going to write my paper in my office, maybe with my research assistant, share it at a conference with a colleague or with a few colleagues, maybe send it to some other colleagues to give feedback and so on. Send it to a publisher, publish it, and then build on it. We've seen multiple instances of people posting sections of papers on their blogs, inviting comment, and then those sections finding themselves in the paper in refined forms. Debates and commentary, sharing of syllabi and activities, and the posting of public PMT materials. I don't know what the term is in South Africa, but promotion and tenure materials are materials that academics submit in the U.S., that's a U.S.-centered term, for their promotion and tenure, right? So it's a dossier of their 5 years at the institution that basically says, this is what I taught, this is my research, here's a teaching statement.
Portfolio.
So we've seen a number of examples of academics posting those portfolios in public spaces, sharing them with others. And if you've gone through this process, you'll recognize that this is usually a very closed institutional process that happens, you know, within the confines of a department and then a college and so on. So I think it's really interesting to ask questions like, well, why are these people sharing these materials online, right? Why would you, share your student evaluations on your blog? What is the reason behind that? So those are some of the questions that we've been asking to try to find some answers. We also looked at Twitter as a space just to understand if there's different practices that are happening on Twitter that might differ from the kinds of practice that people do on their blogs, and we found very similar things. But this essentially highlights the sharing that occurs on that space, usually around information and resources, and the opportunities that are provided to other individuals for providing assistance. So I've seen many colleagues essentially reach out and say, I'm studying topic X. Does anyone know the literature on that topic? What are the major works on that topic? And we've also seen the opposite happen when individuals ask people offering feedback on the topic. So you've heard me kind of describe these activities and use words like many and a lot and a few and so on. And you know, I often get the question, well, how many and how few, and is this just a couple of people that really love, you know, the web and don't have privacy in their life and love to share? So, there's been a couple of surveys done to kind of figure out how many academics really do these kinds of things. And the surveys that were done have looked at essentially academics' use of particular social media. And adoption varies. What I understand by reading the different surveys and the change over time is that adoption over time is increasing, so more and more people are taking on social tools for scholarship. And that the personal use of social media exceeds the professional use of social media in academia, right? Depending on the tool, the percentages again vary between 15% to 70%, depending on the tool and depending on the survey. Twitter has a lot of uptake, and Facebook has a lot of uptake. Facebook largely because it's a personal space most frequently, but because there are so many people on there, it's often used in professional ways. And by professional ways, I mean people creating groups for courses or for research interests or or posting updates pertaining to their work. What we do see, though, is that adoption appears to be goal-oriented. So in this survey, there's been accompanying questions regarding what are the purposes of adopting these tools. And what we hear is that people adopt particular tools for particular purposes. So for example, adoption of academia.edu often centers around the sharing of particular papers, right? And in some ways this makes sense because that's what the affordances of that technology allow it to be used as. Twitter is often discussed and explained in terms of sharing my research with others, reaching to other audiences, whereas Facebook is not described in that way. Facebook is essentially described as a melting pot of things that happen, as a place where different audiences come together and contexts kind of collapse, and sometimes that causes challenges for individuals because it's one thing to go on academia.edu and say, here's my new paper, where you know all of your connections are academics. It's a different thing to go on Facebook and say, here's my new paper, friend from high school who I haven't seen for 20 years and who probably doesn't care about this paper, right? But it also goes the other way when our connections on Facebook are professional, and some of the updates that are posted are personal, right? So here's what is happening at my house this week when I'm going on vacation. We are seeing an increasing conversation around reasons for adoption, and universities are often seen as encouraging academics to go online. And you'll hear it often if you go to workshops at a lot of institutions where the encouragement is go online to reach different audiences, right? You'll reach journalists, you'll reach communities that don't often have access to your scholarship. If you go online, you will reach ABC, or you will do ABC. And in a lot of our interviews with academics, what we have found is that one of the main reasons for going online is not necessarily to reach different new audiences, but is to find community with other academics. So even though institutions are encouraging people to go online to do particular things, the people that are online seem to be there for other purposes. It's colleagues who might be suffering from a particular debilitating disease and are going online to find someone else, or other colleagues who are going through the same challenges. It's people who have challenges at their institutions that are looking for other people who have similar challenges at other institutions. We see this frequently with academics who have non-permanent positions, so adjunct instructors, right? So that's a big community where the idea is not to go have a blog to increase my citations or whatever, but it is to go on there and find other people who are facing the similar struggles as I am, and find a community to receive the support around the same challenges. So I've touched a little bit upon the topic of personal versus professional and the different tools that are used for different purposes. So I wanted to kind of throw this question at you guys because it's one I think that that often brings up debates about who we are when we are online and whether we are our true selves when we are online, whatever true means. So so I'm going to ask these questions and then turn it over to you to have a conversation with the person next to you and then come back to discuss. But basically, so there's a Twitter post by someone who's in my network, and I said, hey, you posted this, can I share it with others because I think it's a great quote. And this person said, there's a number of former students on Twitter when they see how we are online, they express their hurt to me because they never expect that we do the things that we do online. You know, and when this person says, you know, how academics express themselves online, right, he's obviously generalizing because, as is going to come up from our conversations, people express themselves in different ways. So here are the questions. Who are we when we are online? It's kind of a really broad, really open-ended question for you to contemplate. That may stem from the question, when you are online, do you reveal everything about yourself in that space? You can think of Facebook, you can think of Twitter, you can think of any social technology that you have an account on. What are the things that you don't reveal? And why don't you reveal those things? And why do you reveal the things that you do reveal? Your conversations can center around scholarship. If you do a lot of scholarship, you know, they can center around your studies if you're a student. But they can also center around personal things as well, right? Do you post about your dog or your child? Do you post about your ailing parents? What is it that you post about, and why or why not? So maybe take 4 or 5 minutes to have a conversation around those questions, and then we'll come back and listen, I guess, to the spectrum of answers that you've come up with. Does that make sense? Okay, let's get back to the large group. Any thoughts on any of these questions? Did any of these spark an interesting conversations that you want to share, Alan?
I just wanted to add a question in there, something like, I'm not going to try and prop the question, but how much of what we are online is actually in our control? And that kind of idea about, who are we, but how much not actually who we are, but somebody else deciding who we are.
Absolutely. That's a great question. That's something that comes up often in the Facebook space, right? So how do other people's comments reflect upon me? So like if I post an article and someone makes a comment, you know, how much is that a reflection of me by virtue of connection, right? So if someone comes in and posts a sexist comment or a racial slur, right? How much does that reflect upon me? Other thoughts? No thoughts. Yes?
Should we be using social media the same way we are in our professional lives? Or should we try to start making our professional lives meet the way we are on social media? Find a middle ground. I mean, I'm not a professor or a lecturer, and I can see that the level of professionalism they have to show is a bit different from me as a teacher. But I have found, since I've been more authentic in class and just be myself and even admit my weaknesses when they happen, be completely human, has worked well, has got the kids responding better and learning more from me and trusting me. Do we think we should start doing that at a tertiary level? Like maybe becoming a little bit more human?
I think that's a great question. I think that that's a question that we all have to struggle with in some ways. I do want to highlight, though, that the professionalism expectations on teachers are great, and they have their standards that they're held accountable to in the community. So don't take those lightly, because they might come back and bite you. But that's a great comment, right? So how much of yourself, of your authentic self, would you post online, and how much are you comfortable sharing online? And I think the question also becomes, how are others going to perceive that, right? Because your students might be responding very well to it, but how about your principal or superintendent or the ministry when they see the kind of things that...
No, obviously in different contexts. I'm lucky with a very understanding context.
Yeah. And I think that, so the idea of context is important because when you post on a blog, right, or Facebook is a great example of collapsing context, because there's so many different groups of people that congregate on there, right, and for many of us, there's many contexts happening online at the same time. A few academics that we have talked to have tried to manage that by having a professional account, having an account just for family, or just restricting essentially their authentic self, right? So they're restricting who they are online to avoid some of those challenging situations, which I think is a fascinating phenomenon when these technologies were supposed to be developed for more sharing and community. And obviously there's, you know, a profit and commercial aspect to some of these things, right? But that tension between how much you share and how much you don't share, I think is interesting.
Hi.
Oh, I have a question. Does anyone have any answers to a question of what things they don't reveal about themselves in the social spaces that they are in, that they would like to share? I'll ask you about that and then I'll go over there.
I have a question instead of, but sort of like sharing my experiences working with people on the same topic.
Okay.
You find that people have got different personas or identities with different platforms. And the argument is that, they argue that in some of the things they are saying there, they don't want them linked to them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is there a danger that they may actually be linked to the real person?
I think the answer to that is probably yes. but I can definitely see, you know, that that desire to share without necessarily being the person sharing or being seen the person who is sharing. We can talk about that a little bit later. I want to finish some of these things. But did you have a comment about the types of things that you might not be sharing?
I think, depending on the audience that you have, I don't even want to reveal what you know your audience would want to reveal. It's like they have a certain perception about it. So you want to live up to that perception. If, say, you're planning to punch someone, you are really thinking of punching them, but don't say
it. Thank you. And I think that's, you know, that's one of the lessons that I want us to get out of this, right? That the audience that is their shapes, kind of the types of things that we're sharing. So when we're looking at other people's profiles, right, to keep that in mind, in that we might understand this about ourselves, that we're not necessarily sharing everything, but we need to understand the same thing about other people. I'm going to jump to challenges that faculty face on social media. Because I want to highlight a couple of those things before I end. But you'll see here some of the traditional things that you see when you ask academics to do certain things, like teach online or try new assessment techniques and so on. So time concerns often come up, right? I don't have time to be on social media because I have to do what the institution wants me to do, which is to publish papers, teach a class, and so on. There's been high-profile cases in the United States very recently about academics being reprimanded about the things that they have posted. So we're having more and more conversations about whether social media conversations fall under the same conventions about kind of the freedoms that academics have in academia, and whether blog posts should be as protected as kind of academic freedom as a paper that they write. So lots of concerns around that, lots of conversations around what that means. Some of the implications of all these things that I think deem our attention. The first one is that there's various practices that are happening online that question the traditional elements of scholarship. So things like posting a paper online and inviting comments, or or engaging with different audiences and having an impact through social media versus papers. I think the question of the platforms impacting the types of things that we're doing versus the types of things that we're doing impacting how we're using the platforms is an interesting one. And then finally, a question on a more macro level of how should universities support and encourage this practice. So what we're currently seeing, as I mentioned, is kind of the encouragement to go online to increase reach and impact. But the people that we've been talking to have been saying that they're going online to find community. So should the university support that, and what way should support it, and what way should it encourage it? So that's all I have, and that leaves about 7 minutes, 9 minutes for some questions, and we'll turn to that.
Thank you very much, James. I think that's really interesting. Step back. We're going to have to be out of here in 5 minutes, otherwise the students will shake the door down. So I think a couple of questions, and then as they start looking hastily, we can just move outside and carry on with the eating and questions in the corridor.
Hi, you said at the beginning of the talk that network scholarship differs from open scholarship, digital scholarship, and social scholarship. The way I see it is that it encompasses all of it. Is that what you were saying, or is it something else?
I think it is possible to encompass all of them, but not necessarily. So let me just give you an example. Open scholarship has a very clear stance on what openness means, right? And it's basically the application of licensing, usually, to allow the sharing of knowledge without restrictions. So it would be something like me publishing a paper with an open license, right? So that would be open scholarship. If I post that on my blog, that would still count as open scholarship, but it would also count as digital and social, probably. But I could publish a paper with a traditional publisher without an open license, right? And then share it on Twitter just on kind of underground way, right? Here's a copy of the paper, even though it has no open licensing on it, I'm doing it. So that, I think, counts as networked and social scholarship. But it's not necessarily open in the traditional way. So I think that's where the distinction between those two lies.
Okay. Any other questions? I can promise George that he hasn't discussed. Oh, there's one. Yep.
I think that academics who offer MOOCs, are they participating in network scholarship, just by offering MOOCs?
MOOCs are an interesting phenomenon from lots of different angles, but I think one of the points that at least is of interest to me that aligns with some of these ideas is the fact that MOOCs have elevated the conversation about teaching. And I think in that sense, the conversations happening around teaching and MOOCs have been beneficial and have allowed networks of colleagues to have conversations around the teaching in particular disciplines. So I've talked to a number of people who have taught MOOCs in education who have said that, you know, either in preparing the teaching of their own MOOC or in preparing future courses locally, they've looked at other people's MOOCs. So I think, you know, even though some of the conversations around social media they might not have been interested in, the development of further networks through MOOCs has been, you know, of interest.
That's great. I think we're going to leave it there because I see that Ian is letting us know the students are hovering outside. George isn't escaping sort of unquestioned. Our PG Dip class has been crafting questions for him for about half the morning, and he's coming back with us for half an hour just to sort of do a quick FAQ, which is fabulous. So thank you.
Feel free to grab these slides from SlideShare. So if you look up my name on SlideShare, you'll find the slides.
Excellent. Thank you very much.